Hey, this is John at Bible Project. This year, we've been exploring the teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. We're currently taking questions for our third question and response episode in this series. We'll be looking at questions from episode 15, which is the eye for eye passage, all the way up until the Lord's Prayer begins. So send us your questions by May 20th and send it to info@bibleproject.com. Let us know your name, where you're from, and try to keep your question to about 20 seconds or so. And if you can transcribe it when you email it in, that's a real big help for our team. We look forward to hearing from you. Now, here's the episode. Today, we begin a brand new theme study, and it is on the Chaos Dragon.
Dragons, they are not just in the Bible. They are all over the Bible, all over all the different parts of the Bible.
There's several different words that biblical authors use to describe dragons or chaos monsters in the Bible. Today, we'll take a survey of those ancient words.
Nahash, Tanin, Leviathan, these are all ways of referring to the same type of creature.
We first meet the chaos dragon on page one of the Bible. It's called a Tanin. And surprisingly, it's created on day five as part of God's ordered creation.
It's good, but what this Nahash is going to start doing is some not good stuff. This makes us look with new eyes at the Nahash of Genesis 3.
Could the serpent, or the Nahash of Genesis 3, the one who tempts Adam and Eve, be a dragon?
Sounds a lot like Daniel and the Revelation. These authors have a coherent way of thinking, it's just different than us. So what the biblical authors are doing is that they're actually deploying well-worn images and storylines, but putting those images in the service of a more unique set of ideas and claims about God and reality and good and evil and humans.
Today, Tim Mackey and I talk about dragons in the Bible. I'm John Collins. You're listening to Bible Project Podcast. Thanks for joining us. Here we go. Hey, Tim.
Hey, John. Hi.
Hi. We're starting a new theme.
Yeah, this is a good day. These are good days when we start new projects, and we're going to be tracing a theme throughout the story of the Bible from the first book to the last, which is kind of what...
It's kind of what we do.
...we define as a theme.
And this theme is the theme of dragons in the Bible, which is not anything I learned in Sunday school, Bible college... Any sermons I've ever listened to, any Bible studies I've ever done.
Yeah.
I don't think that I've ever, dragons in the Bible. You have the right book?
That's right. I thought that's fantasy.
Yeah. We're not reading Tolkien here.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wait, Tolkien doesn't have dragons. No, he does. Yeah.
Oh,
Hobbit.
Yeah.
The Hobbit has dragons.
Oh, yeah. Smaug?
Smaug.
The Desolator? Oh, yeah. Yes. Dragons, they are not just in the Bible. They are... all over the Bible, all over all the different parts of the Bible. It just depends on what translation you read, whether you will see them or not. But even, well, as we'll see, there are some texts that just, they're right there. All you have to do is read that part of the Bible, which, you know, people may not. So when we're doing theme conversations, we are prepping to condense however many hours this conversation takes into a video. And also some other material, you know, that we'll make through Bible Project. But this podcast series is kind of where we...
It's the Fountainhead.
Fountainhead. We trace a theme, and usually I try to pick themes where it appears in the first pages of Genesis repeatedly throughout and then culminates in the story of Jesus and then has some important role in the final book of the Christian Bible, which is the Revelation.
Yeah.
And dragons... qualify. Dragons
Great.
Qualify.
I'm glad they do.
So let's just quick, in this opening conversation, I guess I just want to make the case that there are dragons all over the Bible. There be dragons.
There be dragons.
All over. And the first ones that you meet, and certainly that ancient readers of the Bible would see right there, and did see right there, is on day five of the first story in the Bible about the 7 days of creation. Hmm. Day five has an explicit mention of the great sea monsters. So just sampling day five. So remember, on the 6 days of creation, first three, God separates light from dark, separates the waters above from the waters below. And then day three summons the dry land out of the waters. Days four, five, and six come along, and in the same order, God fills each of those realms with inhabitants. The lights above that separate light from dark. And then on day five, the waters above and the waters below, the waters above are the sky dome, so he sets the birds in the air. Mm-hmm. They fly against the face of the waters above. And then in the waters below, what we're told in Genesis 1, verse 21, is God created the taninim and every living thing with which the water swarms and moves about in according to their kinds, and all the winged birds according to their kinds, and God saw that it was good. So the big question is, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 21, what are the taninim?
Taninim?
Tanin is the singular.
Tanin.
And then this is the plural, taninim.
Okay, he put an im on it.
Yeah. Yep, taninim. But taninim is the singular.
Okay.
Yeah. So just quick survey. New International Version translates taninim as the great creatures of the sea.
Yeah. So that could be just, you know, some fish.
Whales. Giant squids.
Those are crazy.
Those are crazy. You know what's wild is here in Oregon, this winter, like within the last month, January 2023, there's been a large number of whales washing up dead on the Oregon shore.
Really?
Have you seen this in the news?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, there was a huge sperm whale that washed up at Fort Stevens State Park.
Mm-hmm.
And then numerous gray whales at more parts of the Central Coast.
Hmm.
I was reading a short article about it. It's really sad.
Yeah.
I've seen one. I think it was probably a calf once, a beached gray whale. It's maybe like the size of a minivan. It smelled unbelievably bad.
Yeah.
I've never smelled anything.
I think
like
we've
that.
Talked about this, but do you know, like, it was in the 90s or something out here on the Oregon coast? They tried to blow a whale up.
Yeah.
Like it was beached.
Yes.
And they're like,
yes.
You know how we'll get rid of this? We'll blow it up.
So, how did somebody think of that?
But these are the great sea creatures. Like,
yeah.
When in our imagination, when I read great sea creatures, I'm thinking of whales. They're majestic.
They're incredible creatures.
And I mean, just.
And if you haven't seen one washed up,
yeah,
then the only time you'd ever see one is part of one.
Its tail or its back.
In which case, you don't really know
what
the rest of it looks like.
Yeah.
And if you're in a boat,
maybe
you know, but you could easily gain an impression that there's more to this thing than you ever saw.
Yeah. You're sketching the rest of it in your imagination.
That's right. So, great creatures of the sea. The New International Version, you know, opens the category that that's just what it could be talking about. English Standard Version, same words, different phrase, great sea creatures.
Yeah.
The Old King James just straight up went for whales, just great whales. That's how it translated,
taninim.
However, the New American Standard and the New Revised Standard Version both translate the great sea monsters.
Okay, now... Calling a monster. I'm not thinking about a whale anymore. I'm thinking of...
Yeah, what are you thinking of?
A sea monster?
Sea
I'm thinking of like a Loch Ness or like a...
Yeah.
Yeah, some sort of dinosaur
Some dinosaur, reptilian dinosaur.
Some massive alligator.
Sea serpent.
Sea serpent, yeah.
Yeah. So maybe long, so that maybe what you might see come up out of the water with a gray whale, like the back, is just one. But you might think the next one is another, like...
Oh, it's the coils of it.
Like the coil surfacing another one, then with a huge dragon head or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, sea monsters. Okay? So the question is, should we go with whales, King James? Should we go with sea monsters? Or should we go with sea creatures? So let's just do a quick little survey of the use of this word tanin.
Tanin.
In the rest of the Hebrew Bible.
Okay.
What we find are two psalms that explicitly recall day five. Psalms 104 and Psalms 148 are explicitly structured and reference the seven-day creation narrative. And when they get to the creatures of the sea, in Psalm 104, verse 24, how many are your works, O Yahweh? You've made all of them in wisdom. The earth is full of your creatures, the great and wide sea.
It is a big sea. Yeah. It's pretty large.
Yeah. Where animals move without number. Living things, small and great.
We probably still can't number the amount of creatures in the sea.
No.
It's like just not possible.
No. It's pretty wild for just one little flying space rock. And, you know?
Yeah, it's mostly ocean.
Yeah.
It's mostly ocean.
70%, something like that.
Yeah. Mostly unexplored.
Yeah. That's wild. There the ships sail. Verse 26, Leviathan is there that you formed. And then it's the Hebrew word, litzachek, to play.
You formed to play.
You formed to play.
Created the Leviathan
yeah.
to play.
To play, yeah.
That's not how I would describe a monster.
Well, remember, on day 5, God made the Taninim and all the other stuff, and God saw that it was good.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah. It's not bad. It's good. Leviathan. You know, it's a little, it's like.
And Leviathan, what is that word?
Exactly. Okay. Now we're building out the vocabulary.
Okay.
So it's instead of Taninim, Psalm 104. So let's just tuck it away. Leviathan.
What Hebrew word? What's the word here?
Leviathan. So our English word Leviathan is just spelling in English letters
okay.
the Hebrew word Leviathan.
Okay.
Psalm 148, verse 7, when it recalls day 5, it just uses the word Taninim and that's in the deeps of the abyss.
Okay.
So what's fascinating is, in the Second Temple period, Israel returns from exile in Babylon around in the late 500s BC. And then they, Ezra and Nehemiah, rebuild the temple that lasts all the way up till 70 AD after Jesus. It's called the Second Temple period. And a Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible was produced by Jewish scholars.
Because Greek has become the lingua franca.
Yep. And to make the Hebrew Bible available to Greek-speaking Israelites, a Greek translation was produced. And at both of these places, if you look up both these psalms in the old Greek translation, Psalm 104, 148, both the Hebrew words Taninim and Leviathan are translated with the Greek word drakon, from which we get our English word dragon. So ancient Jewish readers found dragons right here in the Psalms and in Genesis.
Yeah.
Drakon. Yeah.
The Greek translation of both of these words
is drakon.
And in the Greek language, a dragon was merely a sea creature or...
No, it conjures up all the
everything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, in Greek myth and lore, you've got the Titans and the all the famous dragon slaying stories.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
When I think of dragons, I think of land creatures.
Oh, land creatures. Oh, okay, yeah. So drakon can refer to sea dragons. Or
what would be an example of a popular sea dragon?
In what Greek mythology?
Or any mythology.
Oh,
sea
serpents.
Japanese have sea serpents?
Sea serpents, yeah.
Okay.
As we're going to see, in the ancient world, dragons were primarily associated with the sea.
Oh, okay.
Not with the land.
All right. They get wings later.
Yeah, they get wings. Wings later. Here, let's just keep going.
Okay.
Just keep working with me. If you look at the ancient Aramaic commentaries and translations of the Hebrew Bible, also produced in the Second Temple period and later, they're called the Targums. If you look at the Targum of Genesis, chapter 1, on day 5, what you find, so for example, there's the Targum called Targum Nefidi. It's an Aramaic translation, but very, almost like a form of commentary. It's very expansive.
Okay. It's not a strict translation.
No, not, yep. So on day 5, they identify the monsters plural. Darkin Mephidi says, and the Lord created the two great monsters, Leviathan and Behemoth.
Okay.
And these are the two
and Job.
Monsters from the speeches of Job.
Mm.
Yeah. So there's other Second Temple Jewish texts, Second Baruch, First Enoch, that also mention God making Behemoth and Leviathan on day 5.
Mm.
So the point is that ancient Jewish readers saw actual monsters on day 5 of Genesis.
Yeah.
That's my point.
Got it.
And Greek readers saw drakon, dragons.
But they were good monsters.
But they're not bad.
What's that?
Okay, let's...
That's like...
We're just doing a word survey right
okay.
now. Okay. So now we've got two words. We've got tanin, which is used 14 times in the Hebrew Bible.
Okay.
We've looked at a couple. Leviathan, or Leviathan, used 5 times in the Hebrew Bible. But then we've also got one more word that gets connected with Tanin and Leviathan, and that is the word nachash.
Snake.
Which gets translated, it's the word for the thing that Adam and Eve made in the garden.
Mm.
So I'm just going to, here's a whole bunch of passages. I'm just going to mention them because we're going to dive into these deeper in future conversations. Psalm 74, it's a poem that's recalling when God created the cosmos. Verse 12, Psalm 74, "Yet God is my king from of old, who works deeds of salvation in the middle of the earth. You divided the sea by your strength."
So that's day...
Day two.
Day two.
Mm-hmm.
Dividing the sea, yeah.
"You broke the heads of the Taninim in the waters. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness." Oh.
I thought he created him to play.
Oh, okay. Yep. Yeah. So we'll sort all this out.
All right.
But the point is...
I feel like we're just throwing puzzle pieces all over the table.
Yeah, that's the point of this conversation.
Okay, great. Wonderful.
Notice how Taninim is in parallelism with Leviathan.
Okay.
In the sea, and it's a creature with many heads that God crushes.
Wow. The heads, yeah.
To split them. Whoa. The heads. So it's a multi-headed sea monster.
Yeah, this is a true monster.
Yeah.
Wow.
Isaiah 27, verse 1. "In that day," which is... a future day that, dude, this is rad text. We'll talk about this later. "Yahweh is going to punish Leviathan, the fleeing Nachash."
Okay. Leviathan is described as a Nachash.
Mm-hmm. "With his fierce and mighty sword, he's going to punish him."
Hmm.
"Indeed, Leviathan, the twisting Nachash, he will kill the Tanin," who lives in the sea.
Okay. He just throws them all there together.
Yeah. Yep. So Amos 9, verse 3. Ooh, this is good. So Yahweh's so angry at his covenant partners Israel for worshiping other gods, neglecting the poor, allowing injustice and oppression, that he says, "I'm going to hunt you down." In this poem, he's, "I'm going to hunt you down."
Wow.
And so Amos 9, verse 3, "Even if they hide on the summit of Mount Carmel, I'm going to search them out and take them out there. If they conceal themselves from my eyes on the floor of the sea, from there I'll command the Nachash, and it will go bite them."
Whoa. Gosh.
That's gnarly.
So there's no mountaintop you can flee to.
Yeah.
And there's no depths of the ocean you can flee
to.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because down there, God's got the Nachash.
Yeah. So if you're on a mountain, you're up in God's territory of the heavenly... right? Uh-huh. Heavenly throne room. But down in the seas, he's got agents down there.
In what meaningful way is an ancient person going to go hang out in the bottom of the ocean?
Well, it's poetry.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. Ooh, this is an interesting one. Jeremiah 51. "Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, has devoured me and crushed me." So this is Jeremiah, who lived in Jerusalem when Babylon was being besieged by Nebuchadnezzar's armies and was taken. So he describes Nebuchadnezzar as having a mouth that can eat and swallow Jerusalem.
Hmm.
"He set me down like an empty vessel. He swallowed me up like a tanin. He's filled his stomach with my delicacies, and then he washed me away," meaning
he exiled him.
Vomited me out.
Oh, oh.
Like he gushed him out.
Oh, wow. So Nebuchadnezzar here is being described as
a sea monster.
A sea monster.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sheesh.
Who swallows up Israelites and then
vomits them out.
Vomits them out. That sounds like a story I know.
Hmm.
In fact, Ezekiel 29 is a set of oracles of an Israelite prophet Ezekiel against Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And in chapter 29, verse 3, he says, "This is what the Lord God says. I am against you, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, O great Tanin that lives in the midst of the rivers. You say, 'The Nile is mine. I have made it.' But I will put hooks in your jaws."
He's going to fish out the Tanin.
"I'm going to make the fish of your rivers cling to your scales."
This is a...
"I'm going to haul you up out of the rivers and all the fish will cling to your scales. And he says, I'm basically put your carcass on the land and all the animals are going to eat you. But notice again, it's a king. It's a tyrant king.
Yeah, the Pharaoh.
An imperial king who like conquers other nations and plunders them, like Nebuchadnezzar. So humans, kingdoms can be like sea monsters.
Yeah.
Yeah. So these are all examples where our three words are all mixing and mashing together here.
Yeah. There be dragons.
Yeah, there be dragons. So this makes us look with new eyes at the Nahash of Genesis 3 that we meet. Now, that's a land creature.
And so when you say Genesis 3, you mean the story of Adam and Eve in the garden.
Yeah, yeah.
Who all of a sudden this character shows up and it's a Nahash.
Yeah, a Nahash.
Which is translated snake, but it's talking.
That's totally right. Yeah, yes. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. It's talking. And the only, for an ancient reader whose mind has all these connections already, the only thing you would know to link it back to, well, I think there's a couple things you would know to link it back to. And this, we'll go into this, and we have done in previous podcast series, like in the Firstborn series, we did a long meditation on the relationship of the humans and the sky rulers, human land rulers, sky rulers, and then the snake. Here, the Nahash, the last thing in Genesis, in the two chapters that come before that you would associate with Nahash, are the Tananim of day five of Genesis.
But like you said, this one is not a sea creature.
Correct.
It's on the land.
It's on the land. Yep. But I'm just saying, in terms of word association,
sure.
Nahash, Tanin, Leviathan, these are all ways of referring to the same type of creature. A monster of the deep. Well, it's good on day five. But what this Nahash is going to start doing is some not good stuff.
So if I was, if I was an ancient who, like, these words were all melded together, like, what passage was that in, Amos? Where it's like all three of them, they were all synonyms.
Oh, Isaiah chapter 27, where the Leviathan, the fleeing Nahash, the Tanin in the sea. Yeah.
So if those words are all a bundle, and I'm reading Genesis 3, and a Nahash comes— In my mind, I almost imagine this like...
A dragon?
This sea dragon that's like slithered out of the ocean onto the land.
Yeah.
It's still kind of dripping and scaly and fierce. And it's like, hey. So what did God say?
Yeah, exactly. Like a beast coming up out of the sea.
A beast coming up out of the
it
sea.
It sounds a lot like Daniel and the Revelation.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Oh my goodness. It's like these authors... have a coherent way of thinking. It's just different than us. Yeah.
All right.
Also interesting, when the snake, well, when the Nahash does its thing and God curses the Nahash, what God says is, because you've done this, cursed are you more than all the cattle, more than every beast of the field. On your belly you will go.
Yeah.
And eat dust all the days of your life.
So I've, I feel like what I've been taught is, the snake was a lizard that turned into a snake. Lost its legs, now it's a slither.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it's evocative in many ways because Isaiah is going to meet snakes that are throne room courtiers of God in the divine throne room. In Isaiah chapter 6, he's going to have a vision.
What are you talking about?
In the book of Isaiah, Old Testament, Isaiah chapter 6, Isaiah wakes up in a vision, dream, where he's going to be commissioned to be a prophet to Israel. And
you're talking about the seraphim?
He sees what he calls seraphim with wings surrounding the divine throne. And the word seraph is the word snake.
That's another word for snake.
Yes. Venomous snake.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's the word burn for talking about how the venom feels.
when they bite you.
In the Torah and the Numbers scroll and other places, the word seraph means snake.
Okay.
So snake with wings, which were very common way to imagine creatures in divine throne rooms in the ancient world. Egyptians drew them all the time.
Okay.
Snake with wings. So here's going to be a challenge we have as we have these conversations is symbolic imaginations merge visual symbols with their meanings, which means that different looking visual pictures can evoke the same exact idea.
Okay.
And so there's going to be biblical passages, and we're going to look at other ancient texts that use similar images. And to create an actual literal picture in our minds of like, wait, I thought that one had feet, but that one had wings. That one had multiple heads. That one just has one head. And we're trying to do something that is working against the grain of how the symbols work.
Mm-hmm.
So the most important thing about these symbols is the ideas, what they represent.
Mm.
And the visual images in each individual context will differ.
So you're saying whether it's a creature in the sea, whether it's a creature that's crawled on the land,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a winged one in the sky, these are all, they all have a central meaning?
They all have a set of connected meanings.
Uh-huh.
And the reason why the visual descriptions differ from passage to passage or text to text is usually based on the kind of unique context of each, what's happening in each one.
Okay.
So, for example, the Nahash in the garden, it's a land creature.
Okay.
Clearly, it's a land creature.
Can I imagine it having crawled out of the sea?
Well, it's somehow related to that Tanin.
Yeah.
The Taninim of day five.
What if it's a wayward Tanin who just was like, I'm going to go cruise up on the land?
But remember, this is a good example. So in the seven-day creation narrative, the main imagery is of the dark chaos waters. That represents the rival of, not God's rival, but the rival of creation, the disordered nothingness.
You're talking about how Genesis 1 begins.
Yes.
It's just water.
Yep, dark waters. And waters were a common symbol in ancient cosmology for disorder and what we call nothingness.
Hmm.
And the main visual binary in the seven-day narrative is out of the waters come the dry land and the garden.
Order and life.
Order and life in the dry land garden is the opposite of darkness and the waters.
Okay.
In the Garden of Eden story, which begins in Genesis 2, verse 4, it inverts those two images, where instead of beginning with the disordered waters from which land emerges, it's exactly the opposite. It's disordered wilderness from which a bit of waters emerge to plant a garden. So both stories end up with a garden.
Yeah.
But one is land out of water, and the other is water out of land. And the fact that both those stories are next to each other, we're back to it again. Like, well, which one is it? Which one happened? And they're complementary ways of thinking about the same reality.
Okay. So you're saying when we're introduced to the Tanin in Genesis 1,
yeah.
we're using the framework of too much waters.
Yes.
And there's the sea monster.
Yeah.
And there, it's actually part of God's good creation. We'll talk about it.
But it is in the waters.
But it's in the waters. We get to Genesis 2, and we're telling the story of creation again, not through too much chaos water that needs to be ordered, but too much wilderness
yeah.
that needs water to plant a garden.
Yes.
And then the creature we meet is a snake.
It's a snake, which are associated with the wilderness.
Okay. Okay. Because when you're out in the wilderness, they're going to be crawling around under a rock and come out and get you.
Oh, dude. Oh, man. Yes. This happened to me a few years ago. I was on a trip with my family down in the Palm Desert area, Palm Springs, Southern California. I went on a trail run out in the hills south of Palm Springs.
Uh-huh.
And it was a switchbacks up a steep, steep hill. And then I just hit one and just heard
the rattle.
Yeah, rattlesnake rattle. Oh, dude.
You jumped out of your skin.
It was such a primal. Like my body just like, it was wild. I felt it for hours, the surge of energy.
The adrenaline.
Yeah, I just froze.
You know, me and some buddies will go and hunt them.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I told you. You've told me about this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's to like, we're like trying to get that adrenaline. We go find them under rocks and pin them down by their heads and,
oh, man.
And then skin them.
I never saw it. I found, or I could locate the rock it was under and could see the den.
Hmm.
And that was all just locked in place, hoping, I hope it's not close enough to want to strike. Mm-hmm. That it'll see me as a threat. Anyway, so it's a wilderness creature.
Yeah, it's a sneaky, hidden,
yes,
dangerous
wilderness creature.
Wilderness creature.
So what the Taninim are in the waters of Genesis 1 is the symbolic equivalent of what the Nahash is,
right,
sneaking out of the wilderness into the garden, so to speak.
With their venomous
Genesis
bite.
2. But in both cases, it's a chaos creature.
Mm.
So one discussion we'll be having throughout this series is what to call the video. So it began life as just calling it the Chaos Dragon. And I don't know if we could just call it the dragon, because it can be a sea dragon or a wilderness dragon.
But then dragon, like in modern imagination, is a very specific,
that's right,
creature.
That's right.
That's hoarding gold in a cave.
Yeah, yeah.
And this seems broader.
Mm-hmm.
It's a
yep,
chaos creature is kind of the broadest term I could,
yeah,
think of.
No, it's great, because what we're going to see is that scorpions become an associated creature,
mm,
and also lions, which for us, we're like, that's a different species altogether.
Mm.
But in the Psalms, lions and snakes are two ways of talking about the same type of chaos creature.
Hmm.
So the Nahash of Genesis 3 definitely like fits in the same kind of slot as the Taninim of Genesis chapter 1. So that's a quick survey of the Hebrew Bible. There are a lot more passages, and we'll look at a lot more. But I was just trying to help us. I want to build in our mind the set of associations and ideas. So these are maybe, before we move to the New Testament, so these are creatures associated with realms where humans don't fully belong at home.
All right. Out in the ocean, out in the wilderness.
Yep.
You could go travel out there, but you're in someone else's domain.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, the domain of the creatures.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are creatures that are threatening to human life.
Hmm.
If you get close to them.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe a whale isn't probably going to try and crash your ship unless you're Ahab, the sailor, right?
Yeah.
Moby Dick. But out in the wilderness, man, stuff will hunt you down.
Mm.
You know, I think about this. You grew up not far from, and we in the summers like to go and explore the San Juan Islands,
mm-hmm,
which is the island chain,
yeah,
in the northwest corner of the U.S.
There's carnivorous whales out there.
Orca whales.
Yeah, orca.
And I've seen a few pods out there. You know, when you see those creatures, and they're very intelligent,
mm,
they hunt in packs.
Yeah.
And you just think like...
Have you seen videos of them like flipping seals around and
so
tossing
disturbing
them to each other?
Yeah. It's not my realm.
No, you're in their territory.
Totally. And we get in these little like hard shell, you know, motorboats and like, anyway. So
they're not going to hurt you, though. They're friendly.
The feelings associated with they belong in a realm that's not for humans.
Mm-hmm.
They are dangerous. They're maybe not out to get you. Maybe lions are.
Mm.
Snakes might be.
Snakes are kind of protecting themselves.
But yeah, yeah, yeah.
Except for like anacondas. Like those things will eat you.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. They're semi-hidden.
Mm. Yeah. They're obscured.
Obscured. I never saw the snake.
Mm.
You know, when I met one.
And now, yeah, in your imagination, how big was that snake?
Totally. Yeah, exactly.
How big were those fangs,
yeah,
dripping with venom?
And I think the same holds for lions in ancient people's imaginations, because they're nocturnal. They hunt at night.
They hide in the brush.
They make their noises at night. And if you see them during the day, it's very rare.
Hmm.
And it's
okay,
likely to be your last moments. Because
okay,
it,
wow,
will only be seen if it lets itself.
Unless you're
be
King
seen.
David.
Unless you're King David, you take one by the beard and just... So but that's worth meditating on. That's what should evoke in our imagination.
Mm.
Semi-hidden, hard to detect, could be out to get you. You're not entirely sure. You're not sure when it's around, if it's not. And it's in a realm that really isn't like your home.
Hmm.
That is the chaos
creature.
It's that creature. Yep. Okay. So if we're just looking for the repetition of monster reptilian type of imagery, then you won't meet it very often in the New Testament, except just a handful of places. So it's a good example where when you get to the New Testament, these themes are so developed and connected, and then in Second Temple Jewish literature explored, that when you get to the New Testament, you don't actually need to talk about dragons all the time to be talking about dragons. So for example, when Jesus goes out in the wilderness to be tested by the Satan.
The adversary.
The adversary, or the Diabolos. You're supposed to call to your mind the Nachash of Genesis 3.
He's out in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. There's a creature out there.
Yeah, and he's tested in relationship to food, like Adam and Eve, and in relationship to power and rule and authority, which is...
That's all the themes of Adam and Eve.
Yeah, except it's in the wilderness and it's, you know, the Satan, the adversary. However, in Luke chapter 10, when Jesus sends out a group of 70 disciples to go in pairs, and he goes out and he says, like, hey, announce the kingdom of God, heal the sick, invite the poor into your tables, and then come back and tell me how it went. So in Luke chapter 10, verse 17, it says, the 70 returned with joy, saying, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. So even like dark spiritual forces will like leave and leave people alone when we just say your name. And Jesus said to them, yeah, you know, I was watching the Satan fall from heaven like lightning. It's like when the kingdom of God advances, the elevated status of the adversary is brought down to the land. So interesting. And then he says, look, I've given you authority to tread on serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy. Snakes and scorpions, you can stomp on them. Yeah. We didn't read this in Genesis 3. That begins to sound like what God said to the Nachash in Genesis 3, which was, you're going to go on your belly.
You read that.
And one day there's going to be a seed from the woman, a descendant, who's going to crush you on the head while you strike him on the heel. So you're going to get stepped on by a human while also, you know, getting a strike in on that human. And it seems like Jesus is alluding to that, saying like, hey, listen, I did some snake stomping out in the wilderness and I sent you out in my name. And so you have my authority to start putting some pressure on that snake's head, but he joins snakes and scorpions.
And he blends that with demons.
Yes, that's exactly right.
So
spiritual powers, yes.
That's, I haven't been thinking in those terms. I've been thinking about like, you know, God, when I think of all the creatures that God created, I don't think of spiritual beings. So a sea monster, I'm not thinking like it.
You should.
I should be?
Yeah. We'll go back.
The sea monster is a spiritual being?
We'll go back to that.
Okay.
But we should definitely see spiritual beings as a part of God's creation. Oh. They're called the host of heaven in Genesis 1.
Oh, yeah. I guess, yep, they're the creatures.
But they're in the sky.
In the sky.
Yeah. So the question is, what am I supposed to think when I think of the Tanin? This will be our next conversation.
Okay.
Because the Nachash, the Tanin, the Leviathan, these are spiritual beings in the imagination of the... They're gods. So we'll have to form that category in our next conversation.
All right.
But Jesus takes it for granted that spiritual beings in rebellion against God can be referred to with the imagery of snakes and scorpions.
Yeah.
Yep. And so this helps us make sense of why at the conclusion of Paul's letter to the Romans, he'll say, Romans 16, verse 20, the God of peace will soon crush the Satan under y'all's feet. The grace of God be with you. So he's got Genesis 3:15 on the brain, but in the place of the seed of the woman crushing the head of the Nachash.
It's the people following Jesus.
The people following Jesus who crush the Satan under their feet. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the most famous dragon in the New Testament.
Possibly in the whole Bible.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Is in the Revelation, the Apocalypse.
Yeah.
Chapter 12.
This is the last book of the Bible.
Last book of the Bible. And it's a symbolic dream vision that he has. And it's of a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and she wears a crown of 12 stars. So that apparently means something.
That apparently means something.
She's pregnant. She cries out in labor and gives birth.
Okay.
But then he sees a huge red dragon with 7 heads, 10 horns, and 7 crowns on the 7 heads. And his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven and threw them down to the land. And the dragon stood right in front of the woman about to give birth so that he could eat her child. So it's about the seed of the woman versus the snake.
Mm-hmm. But the seed of the woman is being born in front of the snake.
Yeah, exactly. So this whole vision is a dramatization of Genesis 3:15, the hostility between the woman and the snake and the seed of the snake. She gave birth to a son, a male child who is to rule the nations with a rod of iron. There's a good Bible trivia.
Where's that from?
It's from Psalm 2.
Oh, yeah.
Ruling the nations with a rod of iron. Mm-hmm. But her child was snatched up to God and to the throne. And the woman went into the wilderness to a place prepared by God to be there for 1,260 days.
Okay.
That's half of 7 years.
Oh, is it?
Yep.
Oh.
Yeah. Exactly half of 7 years.
Oh.
And now there's a conflict in the skies with Michael and his angels waging war against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels waging war, but not strong enough. No place for them was found in heaven. So the great Drakon was thrown down, that serpent of old who was called the Diabolos and the Satan.
Mm.
The slanderer is Diabolos, and the Satan is the adversary. He deceives the whole world. He was thrown down. His angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, "Now, salvation, the power, the kingdom of our God, the authority of his Messiah has come, for the accuser."
It's another term now for him.
"The accuser of our siblings has been thrown down, the one who accuses them before God day and night." So the Satan, the devil, the serpent, the dragon.
Yeah, okay.
So whatever that means, it's somehow bringing all the themes together
in
a way that's supposed to make you feel satisfied. In some way.
Yeah.
In some way. So, there be dragons.
There be dragons.
Oh, that was my main point.
Yeah. Yes. Loud and clear, dragons in the Bible. I have many questions.
Good.
So then I guess we're going to just go back through and really just start digging into all of these occurrences, ideas.
Yes, but not the next step. The next step, we've been trying to build up an association of ideas, feelings, images around the chaos creature by looking at all these texts. What I next want to do is try and do like a time travel and get inside the mind of an ancient Israelite, an ancient Babylonian, an ancient Canaanite. And what ideas, stories, experiences came into their mind when they heard stories about a deity slaying or confronting a sea dragon and building a kingdom on a mountain over the nations as a result. Hmm. This was a widespread cultural story in so many ancient cultures.
Hmm.
So what the biblical authors are doing is that they're actually deploying well-worn images and storylines, but putting those images in the service of a more unique set of ideas and claims about God and reality and good and evil and humans. But they're doing it, this language is a cross-cultural language in the ancient world.
Of mountains and dragons.
Yeah, so we're going to actually do a survey of the dragon slaying combat myth in the ancient world.
Cool.
That'll help us see how these images pop even more uniquely in the biblical story.
Great. Let's do it. Thanks for listening to this episode of Bible Project Podcast. Next week, we continue discussing the dragon. We'll set some context for how the Bible thinks about the dragon by looking at how ancient Israel's contemporary neighbors also had dragon myths.
The dragon is a symbol for chaos, disorder, anti-creation. So what we're going to look at is the dragon combat myth in ancient Near Eastern culture and literature. And there, the monster is primarily a sea dragon.
Today's episode was brought to you by our podcast team, producer Cooper Peltz, associate producer Lindsay Ponder, lead editor Dan Gummel, editors Tyler Bailey and Frank Garza. Tyler Bailey mixed this episode, and Hannah Wu provided the annotations for our annotated podcast in our app. Additional music and sound design for this series were written and composed by Bible Project staff. Bible Project is a crowdfunded nonprofit, and we exist to experience the Bible as a unified story that leads to Jesus. And everything that we make is free because of the generous support of thousands of people just like you. Thank you so much for being a part of this with us.
Hi, this is Derek, and I'm from West Palm Beach, Florida.
Hi, this is Stephanie, and I'm from Coolewong, New South Wales, Australia. I first heard about Bible Project at my Bible study group.
I first heard about the Bible Project when they came out with their Read Scripture series, their overviews of different books in the Bible. I use the Bible Project for various ministries that I'm a part of.
I use Bible Project for learning more about the Bible and how it was put together. My favorite thing about Bible Project is the videos which go through each book of the Bible.
My favorite thing about the Bible Project is their ability to explain the themes of Scripture, combining biblical scholarship with artistic excellence through their animations.
We believe the Bible is a unified story that leads to Jesus. We're a crowdfunded project by people like me.
Find free videos, study notes, podcasts, classes, and more
at BibleProject.com.